Let's get started. This is part two of a two-part series we began last week. I think most, if not all of you, were here last week, where we are discussing motherhood. And last week we discussed it from a halachic perspective, what makes a mother. And we discussed the two possibilities, which are really, you know, the challenge is the byproduct of the blessing of modern fertility medicine and incredible advances in medical technology, which allow for surrogacy. And we now actually can separate something which obviously for most of human history we took for granted was, by definition, the same person. Now we can actually separate, it's not common, relatively speaking, but it's not uncommon either at this point, in which you can have a genetic mother, the one who contributes the egg, the ovum, and then you can have a gestational or birth mother, someone who carries the baby to term and gives birth. It don't have to be the same person. So who would be the mother in such a case? We did our best to try to find proofs from Tanakh, from Agadic Gemaras, even a little bit of a Halachic Gemara about conversion. And it was really, really quite confusing, and therefore, not in any way definitive one way or the other, and therefore not surprisingly, when you get to the late 20th century poskim, there is the full gamut of positions, which is a nice way of saying, you know, there's a confusion and a lack of Halachic consensus. That being said, we concluded that some poskim actually outright forbid surrogacy. That is definitely true in, I think, in the Hasidic community and probably many parts, I don't know about all, but many parts of the Haredi community. But there are great poskim both in America and in Israel who do allow it as a last-ditch effort if all other fertility attempts have failed. And then there's this huge machloket. Well, what do you do? Who would be the mother? And how do you decide that? And I have been peripherally involved in one or two cases. And it is obviously complicated. But that was the first question. How do you define motherhood from a halacha perspective? Today we are going to discuss a topic that I am, as my wife keeps on reminding me, uniquely unqualified to speak about. And that is, what is motherhood from a more hashkafic perspective? What does it mean to be maybe the one of the most famous, or depending on, I guess maybe if you're like a Catskills comedian, infamous, a thing, a Jewish mother, right? There's there's a whole genre of humor called Jewish mother humor. And it's a stereotype. Non-Jews are familiar with the stereotype. I'm not sure it's necessarily accurate or fair, but it's a thing. We all know this. And I'd like to discuss this from a deeper, not halachic perspective, but to try to understand the guts of it, if you will, the pnimius. What exactly do we have in mind? And when my wife, yet again, last night said, what do you know about this topic? Why are you speaking about this? You're not a mother. So I said, I'm not here, just in case you're wondering, you know, what happens in our house. I pointed out that I'm not here to give you my opinion, although I can. I am the son of a Jewish mother, and I'm also married to one, so I have some indirect knowledge for many, many years, almost a half a century of indirect knowledge. But I'm not here to give my my insights at all, per se. But rather, what I decided to do, when you look around, this is a good segue to one of my important substantive introductory points as well. When you look around, as you all know, there's a ton of literature in the last generation or so about women in halacha, and hashkafically, halachically. I didn't see nearly as much written about motherhood as opposed to womanhood. They're not the same thing. Just like a man and fatherhood are not identical. And what I really would like, even as kind of an opening point to make, is that while there's obviously some connection and overlap, I think there's a very important distinction between the person and the purpose. There's a different, when we talk about the person and how does halacha or how does Judaism, hashkafically, etc., relate to men, relate to women, are they equal, is one better, this isn't fair, this gemara doesn't sound so nice, those kind of discussions, they're discussing the person, a woman or a man or men or women, either way. That's not the same thing as saying what I would refer to as, maybe not the only, we're going to discuss how central it is, but one of the prime purposes of a man and certainly of a woman, which is being a mother or being a father. That's not the same thing as being a woman, right? And of course, the very, very painful reality of women who don't have children, for all sorts of different reasons why a woman might not have children, is the proof of that, right? They're not any less of a woman, but they're not a mother. So they're not the same thing. And we're not here, this is not a class on women in Judaism. This is a class on motherhood, what does it mean not to be a woman? What does it mean to be a mother? Now, what does that say about being a woman? That is a fair question, for sure. And you probably can't completely separate the questions, but we're going to do our best as much as possible to disentangle them. And I actually felt like there's, at least certainly from a Hashkafa perspective, much less written on this question than on the question of what does Judaism say about women as opposed to what does it say about mothers. That being said, the one place or the two places that I was most familiar with, I didn't find that much else, frankly, that persuaded me that there was anything better out there, is some very, very powerful and important essays from Rav Soloveitchik. And really, the whole shiur is, I wouldn't say the whole shiur, 95% of the shiur will be me just unpacking and sharing with you the highlights of Rav Soloveitchik's essays. We'll primarily be working off of two essays, almost exclusively off of an essay in a book called Family Redeemed. After Rav Soloveitchik died, there were, I can't even imagine how many pages worth of manuscripts of notes from lectures that he had given but had never published. And the family set up a whole group of people who were designated and empowered to edit those manuscripts from previously given lectures and to publish them. And there's, I think, maybe even 10 books already. I mean, a lot of books in the series based on different themes. So one of the books in that series is called Family Redeemed, which is, I don't know, 7, 8, 9, 10, something like that. It's not a huge book. All essays relating to the family. There are essays there about men and women. There are essays there about parents. There's essays there about marriage. Essays there about sexual intimacy. Very, very fascinating book. Kibbutz Av Ve'Em. All sorts of that particular book. Now, I double checked, and this particular essay, the one that we're going to be using, I don't think almost none of the essays, they have dates for when it was actually given. Was it in the 60s? Was it in the 70s? I don't know. But the book was published after he died. The book was published, you know, relatively recently ago. And that's Family Redeemed. And there's this one, you know, 25-page essay about parenthood, which is not only, but it's mainly about what it means to be a mother. And we're going to draw heavily from that. There's also a second essay, which we know when it was published in 1977, where Rav Soloveitchik gave on the opportunity, the timing of the shloshim of his machatenista, the Tolna Rebbetzin, his oldest daughter, married the son of the Tolna Rebbe and Rebbetzin, so they were his mechutanim. And when the Rebbetzin died, his machatenista at the Shloshim, he gave it what became a very, very famous hesped, was published in Tradition Magazine in 1977, I think it was. Maybe that came out in 78, I'm not sure, but it was 77. Anyway, that was the time period, basically. And that's shorter. It has a lot of things which are not relevant to what we're talking about, per se, but the core point, it does relate to something that he actually mentions in this Family Redeemed essay, so I gave you a little bit of that. And then last but not least, on a hunch, I just Googled the name. I mean, you can hear the magician is revealing his tricks, is the secrets of his tricks. The third thing I do is I had this hunch. I Googled the name Rabbi Norman Lamb and motherhood. And sure enough, in 1969, Rabbi Lamb gave back-to-back drushas, which we have literally the PDFs of the typed, you know, back in the days, typewriters and like, you know, scribbling on it. We have two drushes he gave on motherhood, and one of them in particular, I hope we'll have the time, makes what I think he made a very, very beautiful and powerful point, which I hope to close the shiur with. And not surprisingly, I think it doesn't overlap, but it's certainly consistent with his Rebbe, with Rav Soloveitchik. So that is our agenda, and that is my hope to pass muster speaking in a room of wonderful Jewish mothers and being the most unqualified person per se in the room to speak about that. But I hide behind the Torah of Tanakh, Chazal, and of Rav Soloveitchik. So take a look now at the source sheet, and we'll try to go through this. Almost all the sources today are in English. There's just a few psukim in Hebrew sprinkled in. So if you take a look at the top of your page, the first reference we have, in any Jewish literature in the entire Torah, to motherhood is right in the beginning, in Perek Gimel, when Adam refers to this new woman that he has now as a wife, Betikra Adam Shem Ishto Chava, right? Who gave names, right? Adam gave the names, right? No one else was there to give the names. She didn't have any parents to make a kiddush for her. She still got a shidduch without the kiddush. And what did Adam call her? Chava. What is Chava? So the Torah tells us, what's the etymology of Chava? Kihi Haisa Eim Kol Chai. It refers to the fact that she is the mother of all humanity. Anyone, any living human being after this is now going to be the product of her. She is a mother. Now, right away you see, and this, Rav Soloveitchik points this out, although he's going to add much more context in a second, and texture to this, but you don't need Rav Soloveitchik, I think, just a slightly sensitive and thoughtful eye to realize the significance of this. Right? The very first woman is named mother, basically. That is, it's hard to imagine a more striking and dramatic statement by the Torah to how central motherhood is to what it means to be a woman.
Before she even was a mother.
Right, exactly. The very fact that she has the potential to be a mother, that is, you know, to use the fancy Latin word, that is her telos, right? That is the ultimate purpose, right? That is the ultimate shlemus of a woman, is to be a mother. I think it's almost undeniable and obvious from the pasuk. The very first woman is named as the mother of all. Right? Clearly a dramatic and forceful statement about how important, central motherhood is to the definition of a woman. But that you didn't need Rav Soloveitchik for. You don't even need me for it. It's just, again, I think it's almost obvious. It jumps out when you think about it for a moment. But what Rav Soloveitchik does, which I think is quite brilliant, is he fits this into what he considers to be a fascinating pattern of human history in which there was a radical change. And he makes the following observation, which is fascinating, which this you could easily overlook. Source number two, he points out that it's true that Chava is named because she is a mother in potential and then in actuality. But he points out, man's name is not identified with fatherhood. Right? There's no conjugation of Av that became the first man. He's Adam, right? Which comes from the ground, or he's Ish. But he's not Av. His role as a father was not portrayed symbolically by his name, while Chava's role as a mother was. Now, once you realize that, again, it's plain for the eyes to see, but it's also so obvious that you could miss it, right? There's clearly a distinction the Torah is drawing between the role of motherhood to a woman and the relative importance of fatherhood to a father. But, and here's the key point, says Rav Soloveitchik, and he's about to develop this, that is referring to a specific time in Jewish history, or world history, you could say, human history. The first stage of human history is from now, the creation of Adam and Chava, as we'll see in a moment, until Avraham and Sarah. At that first stage, it's what he calls the natural community. This is human beings as they're in the most basic, I would say simple, but I don't mean simplistic, basic biological reality. And in that, what he calls natural community, yes, you can infer from the psukim that the woman is more concerned with motherhood than the man is with fatherhood. Now, why should that be? He basically describes it as basic biology and physical reality. The 9 months of pregnancy, all the changes, the pain and suffering of childbirth, nursing, caretaking, etc., etc., etc. All of these create the motherhood experience, and therefore the woman is bound up with a child as she experiences her motherhood in a role in all her thought and feeling. Right? Everything in the woman from a biological, emotional, psychological perspective is tied up with this child. That is a fact which anyone who's been blessed to be a mother is aware of. Contrasting this, he points out, the father, if he wants, can deny his fatherhood, can forgo his responsibility. This is something, I think we alluded to this even briefly last week's year, and unfortunately, in today's day and age, I don't think this is, we have a lot of problems in the Frum community. I don't think this is one of them, but it is a massive, massive plague in secular society of you have men fathering children but not being fathers in any meaningful sense, right? And that's a huge part, again, without getting into the pros and cons overall, but that was a huge part even of the modern feminist movement, a resentment against that and a fight against that. And it's an underlying part of the discussion of abortion rights. But those are all irrelevant today's year. The fact is the fact. A father can be a no-show, right? He does the biological act of impregnating the woman, and that doesn't have to do anything else. We're not putting a value judgment on a man who does that. Of course, that's horrible. But it's a fact. You can either accept it, you can be okay with it, you can resent it. It's all irrelevant. It's a fact. And in the natural biological world, a father's role is much, much more limited. Therefore, says Rav Soloveitchik, in the natural community, the mother occupies the central position, while the father is relegated to a role that is more intangible and vague. So, on the one hand, as we're about to see, he's about to show that there's a shift in history, but the shift is in what could or what ought to be. As I just pointed out, even now, and it was always the case, you could have no-show bummy fathers, of course. You could also have bad mothers, just for the record. I'm also quite aware of that. But there's the natural connection between a father and a child is not the same as a mother and a child. And again, I may not be an expert on motherhood. I don't even consider myself an expert on fatherhood. But I am a father. I'm a father who loves his four children very, very much. I don't think it's the same. And I always felt, all four times we had children, this in the first moments, days, weeks after the baby was born. I don't think I'm so different. I don't think this makes me a bad person or a bad father. Intellectually, I knew right away, the moment the baby's born, I'm supposed to love that person. I can't say I felt it in my kishkas right away, the way my wife did. You could just see it, the way a mother holds that child right away. It's not the same. Again, I'm just speaking for myself. It's not the same. At some point, a father develops a relationship with the child. I still don't know. I don't know how to measure it. Does a father love his children as much as the mother? Maybe even 30 years later, and the answer is no, maybe. But it's, I think, hopefully, in a good situation, it's almost identical, if not identical. But in the beginning, especially, I felt the difference, for sure. So that's because all you have there is the biological reality. Third Soloveitchik, that biological reality is implanted from the beginning of history, and that you see in the very fact that Chava is part of her name. That's part of what a woman, it makes a woman, in a way that's not the way what it makes a man. Okay? Now, all of this was what he called the natural community. However, he points out that there's a shift, and this is obviously what's more important for us. The shift, of course, builds upon the biological reality. It doesn't replace it, but it, or even supplant it, but it builds on it. Says R' Soloveitchik, where is the change? Source number 3. Because there, even though woman is already a mother, she's Eim Kol Chai, but only when you get, now 10 generations later, right? Source number 3 in Bereishis, where Avram is told his name is changing, and why does he go from Avram to Avraham? What's the hey? Ki Av Hamon Goyim. This is where fatherhood is introduced. And it's ironic, because fatherhood is introduced for Avram, not about necessarily his biological children. Right? Because he is the Ra-Ra leader of monotheism, of Judaism, he's going to convert all these people from paganism and idolatry and show them the belief in God. That is referred to as being an Av. Now, what do you see from that, says R' Soloveitchik, source number 4. Apparently, a new idea of fatherhood that was unknown to Adam is revealed to the world with the arrival of Avram. Adam was the father of a natural, unredeemed community. Avraham was the father of a redeemed spiritual community. With the founding of a new kind of a community, a covenantal one, the vague role of fatherhood and the all-absorbing experience of motherhood were redeemed. So let's explain what that means in a second, and then we'll come back to the conclusion. So he's using, this is not nearly as bad as some other essays, but he's using some big words or some technical terms. We'll just unpack them because they shouldn't scare anybody. And then I'm going to make one other observation, and then we'll see the conclusion, which is very powerful. Said R' Soloveitchik, the change that happens when Avraham and Sarah come on the scene is what he calls a new redeemed community, right? Geula, redemption, redeemed, or covenantal. Covenantal is a covenant, the bris, right? The bris ben Absarim, the covenant, the commitment that Hashem makes to Avraham and Avraham makes to Hashem, that new community that's going to emerge out of the children of Avraham, this covenantal community, the community that is based on this bris, is one which is redeemed. What does it mean? Redeemed means somehow to be elevated, to take something that is, at level X, level zero, we'll call it, and based on something, we're about to get to what the something is in a second, that chomer that's already there is now, its status is changed. Okay? So this covenantal community is a redemption, it's an elevation, it changes something about what was before. There was a natural community for 10 generations of human history, starting with Adam and Chava. There was a biological mother and a biological father, and there was this huge difference between them. Doesn't mean there were no good fathers until Avram came around. I have no idea if there were or there weren't. But it means that all there was the biological part of being a father, whereas the mother, the biological part, may be all there is, but that's a much bigger deal than the role of the father, clearly. If that's all you're talking about is natural and biology. In this new covenantal, where there's now, it's not just biology, there's a purpose. There's a higher purpose to being a father and a mother. That chiddush, there being such a higher purpose, is not just biology. That is introduced with Avram and Sarah. That's point number one. His second point, which was subtle, but it's important to stress, is that when there's a transformation, it's not just that the fathers went from being kilu nothing in the first stage, and now they're elevated where mothers already were. That's not what he said. He said both mothers and fathers underwent a change. Sarah's name is also changed. Avram and Sarah are both elevated. Now, they're coming from different places because motherhood was always more central to what it meant to be a woman, then fatherhood is what it meant to be a man. That was his first point. But now when you have this new stage of history and this transformation of humanity, so now both fatherhood and motherhood gain some new, higher purpose. Okay? Now, his point, again, just if you want to be medaic in the beautiful language, the English is so gorgeous, his point, even as he's showing that they're both elevated, but they were both coming from different places. The man was coming from what he called this vague role, what exactly did it mean to be a father initially? And the woman was coming from the all-absorbing experience of motherhood. Because we know what it means to be a mother in a biological, natural sense. A mama bear, right? That kind of thing. But both of them were transformed and elevated at the time of Avram and Sarah. And how so? After the three dots, verse number four, man, and here man means man and woman. Man began to live not only for himself, but for others as well. The idea of sacrifice, the idea of that child being even more important than you, that there being some higher purpose that we're striving for and hoping to bring our children towards, that was the chiddush that takes place at the time of Avraham and Sarah. Now, what exactly does that mean? So now he unpacks that. Source number five. What is this new role of father and mother, which is now not just purely natural and biological, difference between fathers and mothers anyway, but that's all it was ever until this new chiddush, this new idea of what it means to be a mother, and less important for our shir, but it's we need them both to understand them. What does it mean to be a father? So he starts off with fatherhood, but then that'll lead him into motherhood. Source number five. This new covenantal thing, this new role, what it means to be a mother or a father, more than just biology, says Soloveitchik, where it's underlined, it's the great educational commitment to the Masorah, to pass on to a child the covenant, a message, a code, a unique way of life. The father is promoted to teach, and his role is ipso facto, shifted from the periphery to the center, on par with that of the mother. So initially, mothers are much, much more important. In this new stage of history, mothers aren't brought down, chas v'shalom, but fathers are elevated to have a role which is of equal importance, not better, but equal importance with the mother. What is, we're about to get to the mothers in a second. It's like the chaotic, you know, A-B-B-A. So we're doing the fathers, then we're going to zoom back out to the mothers. Sefer Soloveitchik, what does it mean to be a father in this new stage of history? Avram is the Av Hamon Goyim. So it's kind of a giveaway. If Avram can be a father even to people that he's not the biological father of, what that really means is that this higher level of fatherhood is not merely about biology, but about being a teacher. About conveying the truth. Now, it's a truth, thank God, that we've had for many centuries and many generations, which has been developed over time, that of our Jewish Masorah, of our tradition. Passing that on, giving that over to the child, giving over, right, which is, as we all know, again, especially from the absentee father syndrome afflicting the modern world today, right? You can be a father without teaching your children anything, right? In the secular world, they talk about, you know, you don't be an absentee father. You should also be there to teach a kid how to ride a bike and, you know, how to, right? But obviously, and that's fine too. A father should do all those things and, you know, whatever. Talk to the father about, his son about, I don't know, how to date and how to talk to a girl. What are all the things that a father in theory is supposed to do for his children, especially his sons? But obviously from a Torah perspective, it's much more than that, right? It's all of the guts of Yiddishkeit. All the Torah, all the values, the beauty, the mitzvos, the discipline. We're going to get to all that in a moment. But all of that, that giving over, in essence being a teacher, that's what it means to be a father now that Avraham is on the scene. And that puts his role as just as important, not more, but not less, than the mother. When it comes to the mother, he points out, it's not only the father who changes, but the female did as well. Again, even though she was much more important initially, doesn't mean that she didn't have to change. There was a change. Sarah became the first mother in the sense that her motherhood stemmed not only from instinctual involvement due to biological, I left that word. All of this was typed in. I couldn't find any way to cut and paste any of this on the source sheet, so I spent yesterday typing all of this in, and I noticed I made a typo. Okay, due to biological pressure, right? Again, there are women who, for all sorts of even more extreme pressures, abandon their children. Right? Pressure doesn't necessarily mean a bad thing. But a woman feels a certain pressure. You could add, maybe the word is guilt, right? Wouldn't dare, like, of course I have to take care of this child. Right? There's a certain external pressure. As he puts it, it's instinctual, it's biological. That you didn't need Sarah for. That existed way before Sarah too. The chiddush of what it meant to be a mother after Sarah was that she changed, and now she's just like we just said Avram was. A woman now has, in addition to all that, an educational Masorah commitment to hand down and to teach the covenant. A mother is also a teacher, just like the father's elevated, transformed role is to be a teacher of the Masorah. The mother is now as well. Mother's job changed into a great mission. She not only nurses the child physically, she brings him up, she assumes the role of educator. So all of those things, it's very beautiful, it could by step by step, it could be very beautiful metaphors. All of those things, let's say nurturing, nursing, all those things that a mother would do anyway and does do anyway physically, says Soloveitchik, with the advent or this new stage of history since Sarah Imenu, now a mother means all of that, and it also means being a teacher, conveying over the values, the mission, the history, the destiny of the Jewish people. So now you have, that's what he means by redeemed. From being merely physical, there's been a certain geula, there's been an elevation, and now both father and mother, and for now we're considering them identical. We're going to separate them when we turn the page to the second half of the shir. But for now, the point is, as a mission, if you say, what's the mission of a father? What's the mission of a mother? Since Avram and Sarah, the answer is the same. How they'll do it, what role they play in this shared mission, he's going to differentiate on the second half of the page. But for now, what he's saying is they have the same mission. Both equally important, equally central, equally vital. And that is, in essence, to be educators, to be teachers. I sometimes will say this, in drushas, in shul, where I'll be speaking about teaching or chinuch or something like that. And I often point out, again, not that this is some chiddush, it's just, similar to what Rav Soloveitchik is doing here, right? Just instinctively, I've made this point many times, right? You don't have to be working for Masrad Chinuch to be a teacher, right? Every parent is a teacher, right? And it's important because some parents basically feel like, well, I send the kid to school, I pay tuition, so, you know, that's not my job anymore. It's a huge mistake. The ultimate one who's responsible for a child's education is the parent. Because a parent, for all sorts of reasons, can't do that, maybe they're not qualified, they don't have time, they're too busy making a parnasa, so we have this thing called school, teachers. But they're the shaliach of the parents. It's not instead of the parents. The ultimate responsibility is the parents. Okay, drush is over. But the point is, that fits in with the broader philosophical framework that Rav Soloveitchik is saying, that biological, instinctive parenting existed way before any of this highfalutin stuff. And in that part of the world, or history, there's clearly a difference between fathers and mothers. Mothers are much, much more important. And that's still true when you think about the natural, biological, and instinctive connection that a mother or a father has with children. Again, as I said, I don't think it's anything to be embarrassed about. I think it's just a fact. Mothers and women are going to be much closer with their children because of those realities than a man could ever be. But there's this new elevated, redeemed, what he called, form of parenting, being part of the Masorah community, redeemed parenting, and there both mother and father are elevated and changed to be not merely the ones who gave biological life, but are commanded and empowered with this incredibly and critical mission from the Torah to be the teachers, to give over the sense of mission, of Masorah, of tradition from generation to generation to the children that they are blessed to have. And he discusses in the essay, although we'd be here forever if we did the whole essay, it's 25 pages, he discusses the fact that that's why you can have parenthood, even the people who aren't your biological children, and there can be a form of parenthood even for people, Rahman al-Islam, who can't have children. But that's not, he discusses that also in the essay, but that's not our topic, okay? Now, given all of that, he then does something which I found to be really, really striking, and fascinating and beautiful. He points out, again, now we're now way past Sarah even. So now you have the layers. You have the biological connection that a woman has as a mother, and you also have this new elevated. You know, she's not Sarai anymore. She's Sarah. She's a teacher, like Avram is a teacher. We all know, and I gave you two examples, maybe the two most famous examples in Tanakh in sources 6, number 7, that various of the very famous women in Tanakh were barren. They had trouble having children, and you have, you know, Sarah, right, was a reality, but it's more actually in her daughter-in-law, in her granddaughter-in-law, with Rachel, and then, of course, most famously maybe with Chana in the beginning of Shmuel Aleph, where the psukim describe in very raw, very emotional, very evocative, even provocative language, how pained women can be when they can't have children. Right? Very, very heart-wrenching psukim. Source number 6, with Rachel, she couldn't have any children. She's jealous, of course, her sister Leah, and she tells her husband Yaakov, Hava li banim v'im'ayin meis anochi. Right? If I can't have children, I might as well be dead. Right? Well, life is not worth living. Right now, again, when you read it just as literature, Lahavdil, right, if you have a sensitive heart, it touches you. But like, just think about nowadays, right, when we're hypersensitive to that now, right? Anybody, certainly a child, but really anybody describes hurting themselves, right? Every red flag goes up, right? Kids get home, you know, right away, school calls, you know, it wasn't just, my child misbehave? Well, that's a much more serious problem. They talk about hurting themselves, right? I mean, there are all sorts of psychology, there are all sorts of, right, we're hypersensitive to that now. And I'm not saying we should be, right? So, again, I don't know if you have to reread that modern sensitivity into the pasuk. You don't need it. I'm just saying it just jumps, like, what that means to talk about self, all right, did she mean it figuratively? Did she even mean it literally? Was she threatening to kill herself? I don't know. But at minimum, right, she basically feels her life is not worth living if she's not a mother. You never hear a father say that. A man, I should say that. Right? That's the way a woman sometimes might speak. Or, of course, number 7 from Shmuel Aleph, right in the beginning, v'hi maras nefesh, right, Chana was completely depressed because she had no children. She davens to Hashem ubacho techped. She's crying and crying. Right? The Tanakh doesn't use these words for no reason. Right? So on the one, you have this longing for children, you know, in this deep, deep way. Again, I think in a way that no man could ever possibly really relate to, that the Torah and the Tanakh tells us about women. Now, how do you place that? How do you understand that fact in light of everything we've done until now? I think most of the time, when you, again, A, not being a woman, and B, thank God, being part of a married couple that was blessed to have children. So I certainly don't know anything about this on a personal level. But to the extent that I know people, Nebuch, who have not been able to have children, who have struggled to have as many children as they want, et cetera, and it can be incredibly painful for sure, I think if you would ask me, I would have just assumed that that's predominantly because of the incredible deep biological, natural, psychological need that women have to want to be mothers. There are men who also want to be fathers, but you cannot compare. In other words, what I'm saying is I would have assumed that these psukim or this reality testifies to the first level of being a mother, of Eim Kol Chai. Right? If Chava is named Eim Kol Chai, so what am I if I'm not a mother? And I'm not saying that's not true, but Rav Soloveitchik actually looks at it from a different perspective. Soloveitchik says he thinks, at least in the Tanakh, the reason that women are so pained if they can't have children is not, I'll add the word, merely because biologically, psychologically, like Chava, they would have wanted one, but rather it's because they have a desperate need to want to be like Sarah. We want to be teachers. We want to be able to give over the Mesorah to somebody. And if we can't, then we feel robbed. He makes this point in source number 8. Yes, there was a basic difference, he says, between Chava's yearning for a child. Again, he assumes that Chava would have wanted to have children like any other woman would want to have children. For sure. But that's not what was going on with Rachel. It's not what was going on with Chana. Because when Chava or some other, you know, again, these are categories or stereotypes, when that first level, when a person only has the first level of wanting to be a mother, that's not related, he says, to a great goal. Is purely egotistic, instinctual, a primitive desire. Chava wanted to be a mother because she felt the need not only to be loved, but to love. That's a very, very beautiful sentence. I think it, you know, perfect sense, right? A person, you're loved by your children, that certainly is a very good feeling. And certainly, for example, people who never get married, right, they're desperate to be loved. But there's also something that is deep inside every person, and I think especially inside of a woman, which is not only to be loved, but a woman wants to love. They want someone that they can give to love. That's what Chava wanted. Now, that's really about her needs, right? That's what it means by egotistic. It's not a bad, it doesn't mean like you're selfish in some really nasty way, but it's all about me. My needs are, I want to be loved, and I also want to love. Right? That's better than some other needs that we have, but it's still a selfish need. Okay? And still very instinctive, very biological. However, he points out, in the covenantal community, again, that's the world now we have post-Sarah and Avraham, where we're part of this grand narrative and story of giving over the Jewish people, the urge to love is purged from its egotistic, instinctual elements. It's no longer just about me, 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 and what I need. And it turns into the need to serve. Not to get, but to give, to sacrifice, to participate in the great adventure of being a people of God and a messianic community. The covenantal mother's desire and craving for a child flow from the deep recesses of her personality where God's image is engraved. In other words, what he's saying, again, I'm adding that I don't think it's one or the other, that it could be both. That's me. I hope I'm right in interpreting him that way. But it's not only a biological or instinctive, and in that sense you can maybe even say somewhat superficial or selfish, desire to have a child, maybe in the same way that a man might, and even in the deeper way that maybe there are biological differences between men and women, and therefore the need to have a child in terms of what it does for me and my definition, am I a woman, am I a man, if I haven't had children, then clearly men and women see that, would answer those questions differently, typically. That may still exist, but his point is that he thinks, at least from the role models that we're describing in the Tanakh, it's a much deeper need, and therefore a much higher calling that they feel they're being robbed of. Not just, again, I'm adding the word just, not just that on a human, instinctive, biological, psychological level, I want to have someone to nurture and to cuddle and to nurse and to do the diapers and to all the stuff that I would want naturally, psychologically, instinctively, and I want to feel loved, I want to give love, but it's more than that. It's something even deeper than that. And that is because in the shorish, in the deepest parts of our neshama, men and women are created in the image of God. And Hashem is a creator. And Hashem is a metiv. He quotes, I didn't put it on the sheet, but he quotes, we know the Kabbalistic, you know, the Kabbalists have an answer to the question of all questions, right? Why did God create the world? If he was perfect, he didn't need it. So the Kabbalistic, or he calls the mystical answer to that question is, because he wanted to be a metiv, he wanted to give. Right? He didn't need anything, he wasn't getting anything, but he wanted to be able to give. So center of salvation, yes, and every person, and especially a mother, has that ability biologically to be able to be the giver of life. Right, man, there's nothing a man can do that's remotely as close to as godlike as what a woman can do when she has a child. That's what he's alluding to in that last sentence. Right, God's image is deeply engraved on a woman's neshama. It's deeply engraved on a man's neshama too. But and there's ways that men can express that. But that ability to give life and then be able to be mated, to give to that life that you've now given birth to, and bring that new child into the next generation of the Masorah, what he calls the covenantal community, to give over the tradition, et cetera, everything that he's talking about that was introduced into the world from Avram and Sarah's time. When a woman can't have that, that's what Rachel and Chana are so pained by. And I think, again, I don't know, Rahman al-Litzlan, you know, if a person starts people to know themselves when they're in pain, let alone other people to know what they're going through. But I wonder, you know, to what extent maybe that really is true nowadays. Is it only true for the great heroines of Rachel and Chana? Or maybe many from women, unfortunately, who have trouble having children. Again, I'm sure there's the purely human, you know, which again, I'm not judging them, but, you know, basically selfish need to want to have children. But how much of it might also be on a deeper level, not only because they want children. They want to be able to be part of this. They want to be able to fulfill their mission. And be able to give over to the next door, right? That's not the same thing that a random person, you know, in downtown Chicago or New York necessarily, a non-Jewish person necessarily feels. I'm not saying they don't. I don't know. They have their own values. But lav dafka, for sure. But that's part of this Jewish tradition that we have. And what's his proof? How does he know this? Again, he can't prove it, really. How would you know what's going on in Chana's mind? But his quote, so to speak, proof for this is he points out that the willingness of mothers, starting with Chana, to sacrifice, to be able to give that child over to Hashem. As badly as she wanted the child, what does she say to the right? What does she say to Eli? Source number 9. If you'll give me the child, what does she say to Hashem? If you'll give me that child, I'll give him right back. If it was all about her, if she wanted the child just because of her needs, because she wanted that someone, you know, at 3 p.m, you know, to sit and do homework with and to dot over and to play blocks with and all those very beautiful things that mothers can do with children, and tuck into bed and tell stories to, and all those, take him to the park, and then would you give him away? Then give him away would be completely point. Well, give me the child so I can give him back. There'd be no point. But says Soloveitchik, if you turn over the page, if the whole point was, I want a child so that I can contribute to the Masorah, So then it's not as crazy as it might seem. And he points out very beautifully, source number 10. This is really, in the whole essay, I highlighted, you know, like half the essay probably. But I put like big stars in the margin on two paragraphs. This was one of them. Source number 10. Chana is the woman who proclaimed that motherhood asserts itself in the consecration of the child, being makdish the child, giving him away and surrendering him to God. And what did Jewish mothers do throughout the millennia, if not exactly the same thing that Chana pledged? What does a Jewish mother do now when she brings her child to a yeshiva? Now this is like a jaw-dropping paragraph. I think it's a little bit, you know, you could argue it's a little bit of an exaggeration, a little bit of hyperbole, but I think there's I didn't hit, you know, until I read it, it wouldn't have dawned on me, but once I tried to process it, I think there's a tremendous amount of truth to this, right? Again, no one, you know, other than some crazy stories in the time of the Holocaust, Nebuch, right? No mother other than Chana is, you know, asking for a child to then give him away. That was a relatively rare thing in human history. And yet, says R. Soloveitchik, it's a paradigm. Because the sacrifice, what was in essence Chana doing? She was saying, I want my motives for wanting to be a mother, again, I don't know if they were exclusively, but they were so predominantly about what it means to be not just a mother in a biological sense, but what it means to be a Jewish mother, a Masorah mother, a redeemed mother, a Sarah Imenu, not a Chava, that she was willing to sacrifice her personal... You don't think she wanted Shmuel at home? Of course she would have wanted little baby Shmuel to be playing at home. But she was willing to sacrifice him if that was for the greater good, because it was really for that greater good that she wanted the child to begin with. Sarah Soloveitchik, that willingness of Jewish mothers to sacrifice was maybe best for them, because for the Masorah, more distance with their child is maybe better for the child and better for the Masorah. Says that's what Jewish mothers have been doing, not just in the Holocaust, those are extreme situations, but that's what Jewish mothers do on some much, much, much more, I'm adding, diluted level, but on the same way throughout history. Right? Again, I'm not here to tell you whether you should send your kids to, let's say, I don't know if you have sons, to a dorm or not. But we sent all three of our sons to dorms, and there are people in this room who have children in dorms, and there are other people who have chosen not to do that. And I've had conversations with people in the shul asking me for advice where to send their eighth grade son, and I don't want to send them away, and what are the best options if I don't send them away? Should I be willing to send them away? Right? Those are not answer questions, you know, that there's one size fits all for. But no one, I mean, if you're a normal parent, no one wants their child out of the house, I mean, unless you really have a dysfunctional family. So why is it that people, mothers, but fathers, but especially mothers, who love their children, are willing to do it? Yeah, it doesn't mean if you didn't do it, it means you wouldn't have been willing, right? Sometimes it's maybe better for the child not to do it. Every child and every situation is different. But the willingness to do it, Sarah Soloveitchik, okay, he goes so far as to say she just brings them to yeshiva, like you walk them, right? Just everything, you, again, the tuition, all the things that we're doing to sacrifice. There are a lot of capital S's, but a lot of lowercase S's, but they're still sacrifices. And we do that because our desire and our identity as a mother, and as a father to a less extent, but as a mother, is ultimately about this. Now, again, I knew that we'd have, you know, so much material that we'd be running late, so we are. So let's try to do the second half of the shiur a little bit more briefly, a little bit quicker. We'll probably maybe read a little less inside, but since so much of it is English, it should be fine. Now let's move to the third and fourth of the final stages of the shiur, which is now that we've discussed in so many ways how, again, throughout this transformation of human history, the what he calls the Chava to Sarah transition and transformation, which transformed men and women, into being not only biological parents, but also this spiritual sense of motherhood from a Jewish perspective as a teacher, as a conveyor of the Masorah. And until now, all he has said is that now both parents have that role, that fathers now are as important as mothers. But it's clear in numerous of his writings, I'm not even discussing other Baalei Machshava, that he doesn't think that there is an identical overlap between the role within that shared mission. They're equally important and they're the same mission. Just like you might have, you know, the army and the navy, you need different people doing different things for the same victory, to the same mission. So he doesn't think, again, categorically, that mothers and fathers have the same mission. And here I want to turn our attention. There's like a little bit of a page and a half in this essay where we're mainly quoting Family Redeemed. There's about a page and a half where he makes this point, but it's most famous, and it's much longer, in source number 11, which is this tribute to the Rebbetzin of Talna. As I mentioned, that is the hesped he gave for his Machatenista in 1977 in Boston. And there he points out something which I think is very, very powerful, which is that for all sorts of reasons, people mistakenly think that there's one Mesorah, and Mesorah means men and fathers. Right? After all, as he points out in Sesam Perkei Avos, Moshe Kibbutz Torah Misinai, and then there's a long list of people that Moshe gave the Torah to, and they all happen to be men and fathers, right? Not women. So Seder Soloveitchik, it's a mistake. In fact, there is a Mesorah of the fathers, yes, it's true, but there's actually a second Mesorah, and that is two Mesorahs, as he points out, two Shalshalot, two Mesorah communities, that have the fathers and that of the mothers. And he points out two very famous psukim that indicate this, right? Kosomer the Beis Yaakov, Vasagil ben Israel, right? You have parallel teachings to the women and to the men, or of course you have the pasuk in Mishlei, Shema b'ni Musar Avicha, v'al titosh, Toras Imecha. There's two different models. There's Musar Avicha, but there's also Toras Imecha. So Seder Soloveitchik, it's clear that there are two different Mesorahs. What is the distinction between Musar Avicha and Toras Imecha? And here, again, I think it's obvious, but I'll just make the point. He's speaking, and what I was referring to before is either stereotypical or categorical terms. No man is purely this, no woman is purely that, and it's not necessarily meant to be exclusive. But certainly over time, and over the mass numbers of people, or Soloveitchik, I think, would absolutely be convinced that there are certain basic differences and patterns that you see in the roles and strengths of women, respectively, and the roles and strengths missions of mothers, respectively. And the way he describes it, we'll paraphrase the father part because it's not as important as the mother part, but he talks about the father being, to some extent, more of the disciplinarian, giving over discipline, the discipline of Judaism, right? Judaism is not all fun and games, all sorts of rules, do's and don'ts, conceptually, how to think, how to analyze, how to read a text, etc., etc. But if that's the father, he says, what in the middle of the paragraph? What does a mother pass on? So here he admits to my wife's critique. Right? How am I, as a male, Seder Soloveitchik, you know, he says, I can't really precisely define the Masoretic role of the Jewish mother, right? I'm not a mother. But he didn't give up, which is why neither did I. He says, but permit me to draw my own experiences. And he doesn't turn to his wife, who he loved very much and was blessed with three children with, but he turns more towards what he saw growing up with his own mother. Here, you may have heard me quote this in previous shiurim. I think this is among the most beautiful words ever written, and certainly Torah ever written in English. This to me has got to be in anyone's top five list of some of the most beautiful things ever written. Said, again, I'm paraphrasing what is about a page and a half into a paragraph, but he says here, talks about all the different things he learned from his mother. He talks about how basically she was around the house, she was a homemaker, and when he was a kid, he was around the home, and a lot of times he would just observe her, sometimes she would talk to him, but it was really more him listening, it wasn't a conversation, it was a monologue, but all the things, you know, he learned from the way she would daven, he watched the way she would read the Parsha every Friday night, different things like that, and then he says, most of all, I learned that Judaism expresses itself not only in the formal compliance with the law, that's what he learned from his father, but from his mother he learned also in a living experience. She taught me that there is a flavor, a scent, a warmth to mitzvos. I learned from her the most important thing in life, to feel the presence of the Almighty and the gentle pressure of his hand, sorry for the typo, resting on my frail shoulders. Without her teachings, which were quite often transmitted to me in silence, I would have grown up a soulless being, dry and insensitive. In other words, what he's saying is the formality of Judaism, and Judaism has a lot of formality, that I got from my father. But the experience, the emotion of Judaism, the life of Judaism, I got from my mother. And as he put it, what's the single most important thing a Jew can have in life? Again, I've quoted this in the past, I often, you know, I want to stress, this is not Rabbi Nachman speaking, not the Lubavitcher Rebbe or any other Hasidic or mystical thinker. This is Soloveitchik, who is the Lithuanian rationalist, brisker, PhD, academic, whatever stereotype you want to use, par excellence. And what he's saying is the most important thing in life is to feel the presence of Hashem, to feel God in your life, as he puts it so beautifully, to feel his hand resting on my frail shoulder. And if Soloveitchik basically is saying, I have that in my life. I feel Hashem in my life, he's saying. And I got that not from my father, who I learned over 20 mesechtas with, I think I've mentioned in previous shiurim, I am not aware, certainly the last few hundred years, I am not aware of a single father-son tandem of Gedolei Yisrael who learned more Torah together and had more of an immediate influence of father to son. In literally in hundreds of years, I'm not aware of anything even close to as the influence that Rav Soloveitchik's father had on him. And yet, despite all that, he says, I didn't learn from my father the most important thing in life. That I learned from my mother. To experience Hashem. To feel Judaism's alive. Not just dry rules. And then he just gives an example, which is, again, very powerful and easy for all of us to relate to. The laws of Shabbos, he says. All the Hilchos Shabbos, and this is how you have to cut a strawberry, and this is how you have to make tea, and this is how you don't make tea. All that stuff is I got from my father. But the Shabbos is a living entity. As a queen, that was revealed to me by my mother. The father knew much about Shabbos, but the mothers lived Shabbos. They experienced her presence. And lest one think, that, well, okay, he's separated them, and it's so much, you know, one might be suspect, well, this is the secondary role. This is not as important. So first of all, he's already told you that it was the most important thing in his life. But more than that, if you go back now to the essay in Family Redeemed, Rav Soloveitchik points out something really, really striking. And that is, he says, that, again, this is coming from, this is not just relevant for the role of Rav Soloveitchik's approach to mothers and motherhood. I think this is for Rav Soloveitchik's overall approach to Yiddishkeit, again, given just how intellectual he was. But despite all that fact, not only did we just see the beautiful tribute to his mother that we just saw here, and to all mothers, but he now says in source number 12, he says, on a day-to-day basis, you need both, he's clearly said that, and maybe the role of the father, again, we're speaking categorically, stereotypically, is going to be more important and more prominent. However, he says, in times of crisis and distress, it's the actual emotion or experiential commitment that is indispensable. Were it not for the mother, the Jews would not have been able to defy and survive so many crises which threaten to annihilate our people. In the covenantal community, motherhood is a more powerful spiritual force than fatherhood. When we're at a moment of transition, the covenantal community finds itself at a crossroads, the choice that will shape destiny. That's when the mother steps to the fore. The greatness of the woman manifests itself at the hour of crisis, when the situation requires instantaneous action that flows from the very depths of a sensitive personality. In other words, and this is something that others have observed without the gender application, but if you speak about it just more as intellectual versus emotional, in moments of great crisis in Jewish history, who is more likely to remain committed? People who have only or predominantly an intellectual connection to Yiddishkeit? Or people who have primarily or predominantly an emotional kesher to Yiddishkeit. So as an example, we have a source going back 500 years from the expulsion of Spain, from the Girush Svarad. I don't think we have any historical evidence one way or the other, but we have a source from one of the Kadmonim, one of the great Gedolim of that generation. And we know in the golden age of Spain, they were very into Jewish philosophy, and it was a very educated Jewish community. And there, the Chassid Yaivitz, who himself was one of the people who was expelled from Spain, he says the overwhelming majority of the quote-unquote more elite educated people, when forced with a horrible choice by the Spanish expulsion, picked Christianity, they ditched Judaism. It was the Hamonam, the simple folk, who didn't have the education and intellectual connection, but they had the emotional connection to Yiddishkeit. They're the ones who held firm. That's a famous statement. But that really parallels this point of Soloveitchik. He's taking that exact point, he's saying it's not limited to the Spanish expulsion, but he's talking about crisis versus every day, and he's basically saying that thing which mothers can predominantly give over better than fathers, that's been the key to Jewish survival, because as we know, there have been many, many, many crises in Jewish history along the way. And if all we had was that disciplined, rational, conceptualized connection that we get from the fathers, again, speaking stereotypically, we wouldn't have made it. Right? Which is another way of saying, B'schus nashim tzidkanios, Nigalu, right? Or Afhein Hayub Oso Hanes, which is a machlokes, but according to one interpretation, it doesn't mean women also benefited. It means that women were the ones who were the catalysts, whether it's Yael, whether it's Esther, etc., or the women in Egypt, etc. It wasn't just that they bet, right? So the idea that when you have the very same person, the role, the mother, even more than the father, is the one that predominantly expresses and gives over to the children or to the next generation that feeling of an emotional connection, such as Soloveitchik, in many ways, that's even more important. And then he points out other examples. This is interesting. That's what he thinks is Bina Yesera. which nowadays, again, I think for many generations, people might have poo-pooed. Come on. You're going to tell me I had Bini Yisera, but not let me learn Gemara. So I'm not here to discuss whether women should learn Gemara or not. That's not our topic. But Rav Soloveitchik is pointing out, what nowadays, what do we call that? The way he's interpreting Bini Yisera, the difference between IQ and EQ. And anyone knows what those terms means knows that it's very hard to argue that IQ is more important. I know many, many unsuccessful people with very high IQs. If they just had a little more EQ, they would be doing much, much better. Right? The ability, there's such a thing called emotional intelligence. And that's sort of Soloveitchik's interpretation of Bini Yisera. It doesn't mean they don't have a high IQ. They may or they may not. But what women typically, again, there are men with high EQs too. We all know this. But there are also men without it. What Soloveitchik is suggesting is that women more typically can excel in that, and it's that part of the human personality and that part of parenting which can ultimately be more important and lasting and impactful for the Jewish people. And he points out all sorts of examples. Again, we don't have to go through them all inside now, but you can reference them. He talks about the role that Sarah had in keeping the Jewish people going, Rivka, Miriam, Devorah, the women at the time of the Egel Azov, the women contributing to the Mishkan, etc., etc. Now, lest you think that this is just apologetics and they're just to try to make you feel good or anything like that, which Chas v'Shalom, it's not. But he does, you know, he's very, very honest. And therefore he points out in source number 13, he's not saying, even though he's just got through saying that the role of the mother is more important and it has more contributed to the successful perpetuation of Jewish people, nevertheless, he points out from a halachic perspective, we do balance things, right? Precedence is certainly not always given to the mother or to the woman. And he points out in source number 13, we have this fascinating balance. And I'm not sure he or I certainly don't know how to explain it, but we should at least be honest about it and put it on the table. It says, on the one hand, the greatness of the covenantal mother is expressed halachically when we have the rule that, who's a Jew? Someone who's born to a Jewish mother. That's not fair. Why shouldn't it come from me? Why should it come from my wife? Why can't it come from the father? I want that. What could be more important than making my child a Jew? It's not from me. It's from my wife. It's from my mother, not a father. But that's what Halacha says. A Jewish mother is what's koveya, not a Jewish father. On the other hand, it's true that there are other things which are determined by a father, right? The family name, right? Again, nowadays, I'm not saying you should or shouldn't do this. I'm not interested in possibly that or discussing it. But now it's somewhat more common in more modern circles, whether it's at funerals or at weddings, to refer to the couple, you know, the boy or the girl as Ben or Bat, you know, Avram and Sarah. If you haven't, then you will be probably at weddings where they read a ksuba and they mention the mom's name, or at funerals, or on headstones now. It's certainly a more somewhat recent change in certain parts of the Orthodox community. Let's assume that it's fine, but that's clearly a new thing, and maybe it's not even fine. Certainly historically, Soloveitchik says, yes, a person was always known, whether they're a boy or a girl, as Ben or Bat, their father's name for official perspective, right? When they're a chola, Rahman al-Salam, you're daven, you change to the mother's name for compassion. But officially, legally, are you a Levi, are you Yisrael, are you a Kohen? Goes by the father. What Shevet are you part of? Goes by the father. On the other hand, are you Jewish or not? That goes by the mother. So there is this balance. Why? Why was it decided that way? I don't know. But it's not all or nothing. Both father and mother contribute different things. I want to conclude. We're going to go just a few minutes over time. I apologize, but I'll try to finish. We started a little late, so we'll end in a few more minutes. I just want to add very briefly two more points, and these have nothing to do with Rav Soloveitchik's essay anymore. So it's a very, very beautiful essay. I just gave you some of the highlights of a 25-page essay or so, but I personally found it very, very enlightening. I hope that the mothers who are listening to this found it as enlightening as the father who gave over the shiur did. I want to mention two quick points, which I think are very beautiful. One is based on a drusha that I gave many years ago in Baltimore, on the week of Mother's Day. And it happens to be that that was Parshas Emor. It's often Parshas Emor. They come out around the same time. That made up thing in America called Mother's Day. And Parshas Emor. And in Parshas Emor, we have a very wild story, or if we'll call it the end of the Parsha, about a man whose name we don't know. But he did some horrible sin in the community, in the Jewish camp. He's cursed God or something, and he gets terribly punished. But he's referred to without his own name, but we only know his mother's name. The Torah goes out of his way just to say his mother's name, right? Shlomis Bas Divri was his mother. So everyone notes that it's just bizarre. We don't typically even mention a mother's name in with random characters in Tanakh. And here we don't even know his name. We're only told the mother's name. So Rabbeinu Bachai in source number 14 says, you want to know why it's his mother's name? Hold on to your seats. Because it was her fault. It's her fault. A child who could do such a sin, Right? It's just reminiscent of, right? Sometimes, I think I'm going to tell you the story that we were once, many years ago when we were a young couple, we were eating at someone's Shabbos table, and one of their two-year-old son, who at the time was the same age as my two-year-old daughter, it's like playing in, you know, we were one of these little Riverdale apartments, so we're all, the living room, dining room is bakoshi, two rooms, but it really was one room. All of a sudden, you hear the kid cursing. Now, that's really embarrassing, not because your kid cursed. Why is that embarrassing? Because who do you think the kid learned it from, right? Everyone at the table knows the reason the kid's cursing, because apparently he heard it from. Now, in this case, Rabbeinu Bachai doesn't say learned it from mommy and daddy, they learned it from mommy. If this Makalel is doing this thing, says Rabbeinu Bachai, you know why the mother's mentioned? Because it was her fault. But then he points out, he's not picking on her or picking on mothers being negative, chas v'shalom. Rather, what he's saying is, mothers are the predominant influence on their child, much more than fathers, he says. And therefore, that's why in this case, when he did something bad, the more of the teva is nikasher b'teva ha'im yoter me'teva ha'av. A child is more connected to his mother than his father. And therefore, he says, it's not only for bad, huwa din etzel ha'tova. Of course, it's true for the good as well. Kisha adam tzadik, ubal anava, v'ish midot. A person says, oh, al getamailas. Hinen zemofes al ha'ima. That shows that the mother was modest and righteous, etc., etc. That's where the child would get it from. Ki ha'anaf ha'tov, Ya'id amalat hasharesh. What a beautiful line. A strong branch testifies to a strong root, to a strong trunk. Right? Very, very powerful. So Rabbeinu Bachai, I'm just dropping this kind of truth bomb on you at the last moment, just to point out, I think, again, it's not per se connected to Rav Soloveitchik today, but if you ask me, my perspective, I think this is absolutely true, and I think it's true out of Yom Hazeh. Of course, there are plenty of families where the mother is less involved, or some children are more connected, closer to their father, or their children. Obviously, but I think as an overall rule, there's no more, no stronger influence on a child than the mother. And I think that Judaism has always recognized this, and it fits very beautifully with some of the things that we just saw from Rav Soloveitchik. Here you have Rabbeinu Bachai. This is a Talmud of the Ramban, hundreds of years before Rav Soloveitchik. Rabbeinu Bachai makes that point. Last but not least, I want to end with this, and this is the part that came from Rabbi Lamb. So I don't know what he was exactly responding to in 1969, but apparently there was a particular book or Broadway show or something. Maybe that's the whole genre of Jewish mother jokes started. And all sorts of making fun of Jewish mothers being too overbearing and loving, smothering, not mothering. He must have been responding to something like that. Anyway, in that context, he has a stunning, stunning drasha. And he goes back to Shmuel, right? I didn't give you the pesukim because I ran out of page on the page. But he points out that the pasuk there in Shmuel Aleph talks about how Chana, what do you think, she just gave him over to the Beis HaMikdash, never saw him again? The Tanakh tells us that she would come every year, three times a year, to Aliyah L'Regel, to the Beis HaMikdash on the Gimel Regalim. And the Tanakh tells us, she umi'il katan ta'asalo imo. She made him a little robe or a little coat, and she used to bring it to him. Every time. Now, what does that mean? She brought it to him every time. You might have thought that she brought each year. She needed another new scarf, another new robe. He got bigger. There was a new one when he was three, another one when he was four, another one when he was five. But the way the Medrash seems to, the way the Rabbi Lamb interprets the Medrash in source number 15, in fact, something else happened. A miracle happened. She brought him this. When he was a little baby, she made him this little coat, this little sweater, and miraculously, every year, it grew with him. And she brought the same coat every year. He would wear it for the week or whatever it was that she was in Yerushalayim with him in the Beis HaMikdash. And then she would take it home. Then she would bring it back for Shavuos. Then she'd bring it back for Sukkot. And each year it would grow with him. Says the Medrash, source number 15. Umi'il katan tasal imo, bo gadal, bo nikvar, bo Allah. He wore it whenever he could. He grew up with it. Bo Allah, he would then bring karbonos with it. And then most powerfully, says the Medrash, and years after his mother had died, he left in his will that he should be buried wearing that sweater, that robe that his mother made. That's the Medrash. So it says, Rabbi Lam, what is this symbolizing? The mi'il represents a mother's love. The robe which gives warmth and embraces the child is the symbol of Chana's love for Shmuel. But her greatness was that this little robe did not frustrate Shmuel's growth. Her mi'il grew with her child. Her maternal love was given in such a manner that it conformed to the contours of Shmuel's emotional life and needs. Right, very few sentences more beautifully have been written than that. Her love conformed to the contours of Shmuel's emotional life and needs. And therefore, the mother love never frustrated her child, didn't smother him, didn't infantilize him, and even as it never abandoned him. And that's why ultimately he asked to be buried in it, because it was a permanent and enduring sign that he wanted, it was permanent and enduring, and he wanted it to be with him for all eternity. That's what a mother's love is, right? You take that with you every step of your life. It's not only when you're in the house, not only when you're a little kid wearing a mi'il hakatan, right? You have your most, I mean, this is obviously true for fathers, but much more true even for mothers, right? The years where you have the most direct contact is when it's a mi'il katan, it's a small, right, when they're little children. But the love you give them, that small jacket of love you give them when they're small, if you do it right, that grows with the child throughout their lifetime. And even after you're gone, they're still holding on. They're still being kept warm, supported by the love that their mother gave them all the way back. And that mi'il katan. That's what it means, in my opinion, to be a Jewish mother. Okay? My imposter syndrome.